In the classic American style, Herman Webster Mudgett reinvented himself. At the end of the 19th century, he became H.H. Holmes, a cunning and sadistic serial killer. He preyed on the young women flocking to Chicago, made newly splendid for the World's Columbian Exposition in 1893. This is the paradox at the heart of Eric Larson's book called The Devil in the White City. The White City refers to the way the World's Fair buildings looked. The fair's designers wanted to create a particular impression of a magnificent and cultured city, but construction time was short.
To do this quickly, they all had to work in a vernacular that they all understood. So they chose this neoclassical, columns, the sort of Athenian sort of marvels, And they realized early on the buildings could not be made of permanent materials, so they were made of steel frames with wood cladding and this material called staff, kind of an exterior plaster that was very easily molded to look in an uncanny way like stone. Then they made a decision because they had to figure out how to cover this material and do it quickly because you couldn't decorate them in the conventional way. They were too huge. So they hit on the idea of using a gas nozzle to spray paint onto the buildings, the first spray paint. And that way they were able to do this quickly. And to do things in a further way very quickly and also save costs, they decided we're going to have one color and it's going to be white, which was a brilliant decision because you had this startling array of very beautiful buildings, beauty on a level that many of those who came to the fair had never experienced from their frontier lives and so forth. So much so that when people would enter this court of honor, like on a blazing Chicago day, some would burst into tears because it was so beautiful.
And it was the next World's Fair after the one in which the Eiffel Tower had been built. So there was that challenge.
Yes. I mean, there was a sort of escalating series of pressures. A couple of years before, there had been the great Paris Universelle Exposition, and that was a truly an amazing fair in itself. At that fair, Eiffel had built his Eiffel Tower, this 1,000-foot structure, I mean, taller than anybody had ever imagined a structure could go. So when it was finally decided the fair would be in Chicago, there were two things at work. One was Chicago's honor was very much at stake, but so was the nation's honor. In fact, one of Burnham's criteria was that the fair in Chicago had to be one-third larger than the Paris fair and also had to have more people attendance and had to have something to top the Eiffel Tower. Now, interestingly, Eiffel himself proposed to build a tower for the Chicago Fair, and Burnham said, no, we don't want a French tower. Yes, right. Exactly.
Okay, no Eiffel Tower. Instead, they got?
Well, one day, a gentleman came to Burnham with a plan for a gigantic wheel, and Burnham's first reaction was, this is too flimsy looking. We're not going to allow this, and he wouldn't accept it. And this gentleman, whose name is George Washington Gale Ferris, then went back to the drawing board, literally hired an engineer to respec it, do the drawing very precisely with engineering figures and so forth that someone like Burnham would appreciate. They came back to Burnham and to the fair directors, and this time they said yes. And the result was a gigantic Ferris wheel.
We've all seen it so many times. It's at all the state fairs now. The county fairs all right. have a Ferris wheel. You've seen it so many times that you never even think about there having to have been a first one.
Right.
All the while, of course, you've got this theme of the crime rate in Chicago, all of the corruption that is going on in the city. But it's almost hard to talk about because the excitement builds so around the World's Fair, the Columbian Exposition. There's so much going on there, and the rest of the world is watching.
Yes, very much so. The rest of the world is watching. This was big news throughout the country, daily front page stories everywhere, following the fair. But at the same time that all this was going on, I mean, all this really, really truly was going on against a backdrop of the continued mayhem in Chicago. 2 to 4 people were killed each day in Chicago at railroad intersections. This was a major scandal. And if that didn't kill you, there were always the streetcars. People were routinely walking off the wrong side of the streetcar into the path of another streetcar, Cabs and omnibuses drawn by horses were being pulled off drawbridges. I mean, it was a city where so many awful things could happen to you. Also, one of the things that I found so fascinating about Chicago in this period was the smoke. The city was just absolutely clogged with smoke from heaters. If you had a building that happened to have electricity, you were generating it yourself with a coal-fired boiler providing the steam for the generator. place was just packed with this sort of scent, this kind of eerie smoke that on some days you couldn't see more than 5 blocks away.
Not to mention the stockyards again. Not to mention the stockyards. Which meant that you had smoke and odor.
Flies, billions of flies, not just in the stockyard district, but in surrounding districts because of the stockyards. I can imagine that on certain days down there, you know, on a still day, when maybe a Sunday afternoon when the traffic was much lighter, that there would be a constant hum just from the billions upon billions of flies.
You begin to think about the city as you describe it, and there's blood everywhere.
Yeah, there is blood everywhere. And not just blood. I mean, the city of Chicago alone, the municipality owned, I believe, 30,000 horses. That's just the city alone owned 30,000 horses. Each horse generated 20 gallons of urine a day. You think about that for a second. Where did that go? Into the city's streets. And then that's not to talk about the other things. I mean, you know, we don't want to get into too much detail. But what you've got then is you've got this sort of miasma of smoke and stench and flies against which is rising this dream city.
So let's go back to the dream city, and you can see again why people watching the white city rising from their midst must have viewed it as the promise of heaven.
Well, yeah, and when the fair actually opened, it looked as if this had been placed there on the lake by heaven, this glorious 6-building court of honor with the added asset of that gorgeous lake in the background. If you can just imagine the juxtaposition, it was stunning.
All the while this is going on, in the background, at the same time, America's first recognized serial murderer.
The way I like to think of it is he was the prototype for the modern urban serial killer that we've come to know far more often, the Ted Bundys and so forth. He, the killer, Dr. Holmes, used the forces that were building America at that time, that were making the cities gigantic and dangerous. Because, you know, when people would go to Chicago, it was very easy, as I point out repeatedly in the book, to disappear. And that played to his advantage. And also, this was a time when women were essentially on their own for really the first time in American history. That is to say, they could leave home, go unescorted to the big city, you know, live on their own, have careers. But this was a time when, with so many people in flux and so many young women in motion, this is like the perfect moment for him to do what he did.
The bare bones of his story is that
the bare bones.
Yeah. There weren't even bones left by the time he was done. He built a hotel leading up to the exposition,
yes,
so that he was prepared when the fair opened. Invited young women to stay there and killed them.
Yep, that's pretty much it. And Holmes' preferred method of killing was, one of his preferred methods was to sneak into a guest room with a rag soaked in chloroform, place it over the person's mouth, and kill them that way. He was not the Jack the Ripper-style killer. He was a very cowardly killer, which sort of fit the phenomenon of him being this so-called full-blown psychopath. Another method, though, was he had an airtight vault just down the hall from his office, and there was a gas jet that could admit gas into that vault that was controllable from his office. But also, there is at least one case where he apparently was sitting in his office. He managed to trick a woman to go into the vault. He shut the door and just listened as she expired.
There was no air.
There was no air, right.
What's hard to believe is that he could build this hotel with the idea that he was going to use it to kill people.
It is almost beyond belief. And you know, it's a paradox. If I had tried to write this as a novel, nobody would believe it, and therefore, hence, nobody would buy it or read the book. But because all this stuff really happened, I mean, you kind of have to go with how things were. And apparently, the way this guy was able to do this, first of all, in terms of construction, he would hire a group of workers. This is a time when there was a lot of unemployment. He would hire a group of workers, and before he had to pay them, and also before any one worker could see too many components of the place, he would fire them. He would make up an excuse and say, this is shoddy workmanship, you're out of here. And so A, save money, B, no one man saw everything that he was doing. That was one technique. But then the second thing, though, remember, this guy was a true psychopath. And I don't think, you know, until you read the case literature on psychopaths, one has a good sense of what they're all about. We think about Hannibal Lecter's and we think about the movie Psycho. It's not that way. It's actually much creepier. as one of the pioneers of psychopathic research said, this kind of character was not human. And what they mean is there's just simply no moral core. There's nothing there defining this person as human. And what rather in its place is this almost supernatural ability to persuade and to seduce, and that's what he had.
Well, and that seems to be essentially the story. He did, in fact, get away from Chicago. He killed all of these people and walked away from it. If he hadn't been without a moral core and thus, I guess, without the recognition that he could be caught, he never would have been.
You know, he was kind of building. There's this idea that serial killers will continue to push for more elaborate, more organized sorts of behavior. And so certainly he was in the midst of this elaborate, elaborate scheme when he was discovered by accident. And a Philadelphia detective, of all things, got into the case. And this detective happened to be one of the great police detectives of all time, really, because this was a time when detection, criminal detection, was a fairly novel concept.
Even the tools were minimal.
Tools were minimal, but also the idea of a detective division was still a fairly new concept. Scotland Yard alone had only just recently set up a detective division. You know, all the tools, the zeitgeist of detection wasn't there. But this detective, a very dogged guy, the right man for the right time, brought this thing to light. But it was a year and a half after the fair had closed that this finally broke into the press. And when it broke into the press, it was front page news around the country and around the world.
Eric Larson tells the whole story in his book, The Devil in the White City, Murder, Magic, and Madness at the Fair That Changed America. The book was a finalist for the National Book Award. It's now out in paperback.